Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 113.
We are looking at a masterful literary exploration of psychological deterioration.
Yeah, absolute limits of human empathy, really.
Yeah. And what happens when wealth, power, and interpersonal relationships all disintegrate simultaneously?
To give you a lay of the land, just a quick orientation, we are dropping into the middle of a once powerful, impossibly wealthy aristocratic family.
And they are currently in absolute terrifying freefall.
Freefall is the word for it. The matriarch of the family, the glue holding the entire facade together, has just recently died.
Which leaves a massive power vacuum.
Right. And the finances, which were already kind of a house of cards, are completely ruined. The debts are astronomical.
Beyond what we can even comprehend, really.
Yeah. And the characters trapped within this sprawling ancient estate, they're just fracturing under immense pressure. It is a pressure cooker of guilt, paranoia, and desperate survival.
And you know, the setting is this wealthy ancient pavilion, but the core themes are strikingly modern.
100%.
We are dealing with the crushing weight of guilt, the visceral panic of financial stress.
The bitter, cold breakdown of a marriage.
Exactly. And the deep, profound isolation of grief. You really don't need to live in an 18th century Chinese estate to understand these things.
No, not at all. Anyone can understand the cold sweat of an insurmountable debt. Or the creeping realization that you cannot communicate with the person sleeping right next to you.
It's universally relevant to the human condition today.
What grips me about this specific chapter, though, is the wild juxtaposition it presents.
The contrast is just staggering.
It really is. We are going to witness horrifying, visceral, almost ghostly deaths right alongside these profound, quiet, philosophical debates.
Right, jumping from utter chaos to deep introspection.
Yeah. We are literally jumping from a scene of someone tearing their own clothes off in a hallucination to a quiet conversation about whether it is actually better to feel absolutely nothing at all than to suffer the agonizing pain of human connection.
It forces the reader, and by extension you, the listener, to confront how different human minds process the exact same apocalyptic reality.
So let's plunge right into the deep end. We begin with a scene that plays out like a psychological horror film.
It really does read like horror.
It's terrifying. We are at a temple, and concubine Zhao has fallen suddenly violently ill.
And when you say ill, you don't mean she has a fever or a cough?
No, she is hallucinating wildly. She falls to her knees, screaming, crying. She's begging for her life from what she calls a red-bearded lord.
Which is such a striking, horrifying image.
She is screaming that she's being beaten. Her eyes are bulging out of her head. Blood is streaming from her mouth.
It's a total physical collapse.
Yeah, her hair is flying everywhere. And the most disturbing detail, I think she starts tearing at her own clothes.
Right, baring her chest.
Yeah, acting as if she is literally being flayed alive by invisible hands.
The imagery there is incredibly visceral. And there is a very specific cultural and literary mechanism at work here.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. Let's unpack that.
So in much of traditional Chinese literature, there isn't that strict Cartesian dualism that we often see in Western traditions.
The separation of mind and body, you mean?
Exactly. The mind-body split isn't really a thing there. The state of the physical body is deeply, inextricably linked to the state of the soul.
Or the moral character of the person.
Right. What we are seeing here is the text using physical, gruesome deterioration to mirror spiritual corruption.
Because concubine Zhao has quite the resume.
Right.
She's not exactly an innocent victim.
To put it mildly, yeah. In the broader context of the story, she is known for having a long history of malicious, underhanded deeds.
She's done some truly awful things.
She has plotted against other family members. She's used dark magic. She's harbored intense jealousy. She's basically been a highly toxic presence in the family.
A completely destructive force.
And now, at the end of her life, all of that internal ugliness, all that buried guilt and malice is erupting as a violent physical self-destruction.
She's literally tearing herself apart from the inside out.
Precisely. The spiritual rot is becoming physical reality.
I read this and my mind immediately went to Edgar Allan Poe. Reminds me so much of The Telltale Heart.
Oh, that's a brilliant connection.
You know, you have a protagonist who commits a heinous crime, and the guilt is so overwhelming, so pervasive, that it manifests as an auditory hallucination.
Hearing the victim's heartbeat under the floorboards.
Right, until it drives him to confess. I kept wondering, is concubine Zhao's red-bearded lord just the crushing weight of her own guilty conscience?
Snapping her mind in two.
Exactly. Is this actual ghosts? Or a vivid depiction of a psychological break.
That tracks perfectly with the psychological reading of the text. The beauty of this writing is that it operates seamlessly on multiple levels.
What do you mean by multiple levels?
Well, for the other characters standing in the room with her, this is absolutely literal. The underworld has sent a demon to drag her to hell.
They believe she is actually being attacked.
Yes. But, psychologically, as you pointed out, it is the absolute collapse of a mind under the weight of its own toxicity.
Her brain can no longer compartmentalize the things she has done.
Right, so it invents a punisher. It manifests the punishment she subconsciously believes she deserves.
And the reaction of the people around her is so telling. No one wants to go near her.
Can you blame them? She sounds like a wild animal howling in the night.
True. The family actually has to pay a group of brave men extra money just to physically sit in the room with her.
Hazard pay for sitting with a ghost victim.
Yeah. Even the doctor who is called in to treat her, he takes one look, barely feels her pulse, and essentially says, just prepare for the funeral.
He wants nothing to do with it.
He refuses to prescribe any medicine at all. He recognizes immediately that this isn't a biological infection.
The doctor's reaction is a fascinating glimpse into the medical and social pragmatism of the era.
How so?
On one hand, he doesn't want the liability of treating a patient who is clearly going to die. That's bad for business.
Fair point.
But more importantly, he recognizes the signs of what everyone immediately starts whispering about, karmic retribution.
Okay, let's unpack this term because it gets thrown around a lot. What does karmic retribution actually mean in the context of this specific household?
So in this highly stratified, superstitious society, karmic retribution acts as a sort of cosmic justice system.
Like a universal balancing of the scales.
Right. But it also functions as a very powerful social mechanism. It's the belief that evil deeds, even if they are completely hidden from the law or the family patriarchs, are recorded by the spiritual realm.
And the bill eventually comes due.
Exactly. When the doctor backs away, he is essentially validating the rumors. He is saying, this is a spiritual execution. I cannot interfere with the underworld's judgment.
Which means the rumors spread like wildfire through the estate.
They're a contagion all their own.
Everyone starts whispering that she's being tortured by ghosts. And look at how the other characters react. Her biological son, Jia Huan, cries for her.
Which is a natural reaction for a son.
Yes, but then there's Yu Yinyang, a fellow concubine in the household. She starts weeping bitterly alongside the son.
But the text makes it very clear she isn't weeping out of grief for Zhao.
No, she is weeping for herself.
It's a chilling moment of self-interest, but also a deeply tragic one, I think.
Very tragic.
Zhu Yinyang's internal monologue in that moment reveals the absolute precariousness of marginalized women in this society.
She literally thinks to herself, this is how a concubine ends up. I have no children to protect me.
She sees the writing on the wall.
Yeah, she thinks, if a woman who actually bore a son dies like this, screaming on the floor, what on earth is going to happen to me when my time comes?
You can actually see the entire social architecture of the household laid bare in that single terrified thought.
A concubine's status, her safety net, was entirely dependent on the favor of the master.
And the children she produced, specifically sons.
Right.
Zhu Yinyang realizes she has no safety net whatsoever. Zhao's horrifying death isn't a tragedy to her. It's a mirror reflecting Zhu's own terrifying vulnerability.
It is the realization that she is entirely disposable.
Exactly. And speaking of mirrors and the terrifying realization of vulnerability while concubine Zhao is dying in the temple, these rumors of demonic punishment seep back into the main estate.
They act like a psychological contagion.
They really do. Wang Xifeng was the undisputed manager of the entire household. She was sharp, calculating, incredibly powerful, and utterly ruthless.
The ultimate boss.
She controlled the finances, managed hundreds of servants, and she wasn't afraid to destroy anyone who threatened her authority or her wealth.
She was basically the untouchable aristocratic CEO.
That's a perfect way to describe her. But when she hears the whispers about concubine Zhao being tortured by the underworld for her sins, it completely triggers Feng Xi's own collapse.
Because she knows her own history.
Right. She is already physically weakened by illness, but this concept of karmic retribution becomes a virus that infects her mind.
Because just like Zhao, Feng Ji has a very dark history.
She has ruined lives. She has driven people to suicide, all to maintain her grip on power.
And suddenly, as she lies in her dark, quiet room, she hallucinations of a woman named Yu Erji standing right beside her bed.
Now, Yu Erji is perhaps the most potent symbol of Fenji's past cruelty.
Tell us about her.
Yu, Urgi was a gentle, beautiful woman who became a secret concubine to Fengji's husband.
Which was a massive threat to Fengji.
Huge threat. So when Fengji found out, she orchestrated a masterful, psychologically devastating campaign of abuse and manipulation.
A really long, drawn-out torment.
Yes, that ultimately drove Urgi to swallow gold and kill herself. It was a cold, calculated murder by proxy.
The details of this hallucination are just so creepy and atmospheric. Fengji is lying there, bone thin, a total shadow of the woman who used to terrify everyone.
She's completely vulnerable now.
And in her mind, Urgi actually speaks to her. But she isn't screaming or demanding blood like the red-bearded lord from earlier.
Which is what you might expect from a ghost.
Right. Instead, she says, "You've exhausted your schemes, your husband resents you, you ruined his career, and I'm here because I actually feel bad for you."
Wow.
It's almost mocking in its pity.
The psychological nuance there is just brilliant. Fengji isn't hallucinating a monster. She is hallucinating the pity of her victim.
Which is so much worse for someone like her.
Exactly. For a woman whose entire identity was built on dominance and superiority, being pitied by the woman she destroyed is the ultimate psychological torture.
That means her power is entirely gone. She's pathetic now.
Yes. And Fengji actually speaks back to the hallucination out loud.
Yeah, she says, "I regret being so narrow-minded."
A rare moment of admission.
But then her most trusted maid, Penger, hears her talking to thin air and asks, "Madam, who are you talking to?"
That specific moment of realization is the true horror of the scene.
Why do you say that?
Because Fengji snaps awake, realizes Urgi is long dead, and realizes she was conversing with a ghost, or worse, that her own mind is betraying her.
But she is too terrified, and perhaps still clinging to the last shred of her pride, to admit it to Penger.
She can't let her servants see her break.
So she just deflects? She claims she was talking in her sleep, and asks Penger to massage her legs. She's trapped in her own mind.
She is experiencing the total dissolution of her reality. The immense power she wielded all her life, the brilliant scheme she orchestrated, the wealth she accumulated.
None of it matters anymore.
Exactly. None of it can protect her from the architecture of her own conscience.
And it gets even worse. She closes her eyes again, just trying to find some peace, and immediately sees a strange man and woman walking toward her bed.
As if they're about to climb right on top of her.
Yeah. She panics, asks her maids who these strangers are, and when the maids look around the empty room and say no one is there, Fengji just goes completely silent.
That silence is the sound of her surrender.
It's a very heavy silence.
She knows her mind is breaking. She is being eaten alive by her internal demons, entirely isolated in her terror, surrounded by servants who cannot see the monsters tearing her apart.
While Fengji is trapped in this claustrophobic dark nightmare of her own making, the text suddenly throws the doors wide open.
It shifts gears completely.
A sudden visitor arrives from the outside world, bringing a completely different, almost jarring kind of reality check.
Someone who is not part of this toxic ecosystem.
Right. A peasant woman named Granny Lou arrives at the estate, bringing her young granddaughter, Kinger.
The contrast here is staggering. Granny Lou is an elderly, uneducated woman from a rural farming village.
A totally different world.
She represents the earth, the sun, the literal dirt of the fields. She operates on a completely different mode of survival than the aristocratic Gia family.
What strikes me about that is the profound irony of their shifting dynamic.
And the role reversal is incredible.
In the past, Fengji was arrogant, dripping in silk and jewels, sitting on a massive mountain of wealth. And she was the one handing out condescending charity to Granny Lou.
Treating her like a beggar, essentially.
But now, Fengji is desperately eager to see her. She practically begs for Granny Lou to be brought into the inner chamber.
She needs that connection to the outside world.
And when Granny Lou walks in and sees Fengji, she is shocked. She notes that Fengji is bone thin and looks completely out of it.
What we're witnessing is a total inversion of the social hierarchy, driven by the collapse of institutional power.
Right, because the power structures are failing.
Fengji controlled vast abstract wealth, ledgers, debts, social capital. But now, that abstract wealth is evaporating and her body is failing.
While Granny Lou is thriving, relatively speaking.
Granny Lou, who has always been at the absolute bottom of the social ladder, possesses something the aristocrats have lost: physical vitality and genuine resilience.
We really need to look at the economics of this. Granny Lou sits down by the bed and just starts talking about her life in the village.
Just sharing regular, everyday updates.
She tells Fengji, If it wasn't for you, my family would have starved. Because Feng Ji gave her some money during a previous visit, Granny Lu's family was able to buy a few acres of land.
They dug a well. They grew vegetables.
They're surviving. They're actually doing okay.
Hmm.
And when Granny Lu heard rumors in the village that the great Jia family was in financial trouble, she literally dropped her farm work and cried.
She traveled all the way from the country.
She rushed all the way to the city just to check on them.
The genuine tears of Granny Lu stand in such a stark, painful contrast to the coldness of Feng Ji's own relatives.
It really highlights the isolation we just discussed.
Exactly. Think about it. Feng Ji's own husband, her extended family, they barely check on her unless they need the keys to a cabinet.
They just want something from her.
They are entirely consumed by their own financial panic and self-preservation. But this peasant woman, who owes them a debt of gratitude from years ago, is the only person who shows uncalculated empathy.
It proves that true loyalty isn't bought with grand performative gestures.
Precisely. It is forged in genuine human connection, which is a currency the aristocratic family has completely bankrupted.
That's a great way to put it. Bankrupting human connection.
Mm.
The conversation then shifts to Feng Ji's young daughter, Kyoji.
And this is where the class collision becomes explosive.
Kyoji comes into the room.
Yeah.
And Granny Lu starts joking around with her. She says, I should be a matchmaker for you.
Which is bold for a peasant to say to a noble daughter.
Yeah. She says, I know you're used to silk and fine food, but in our village, we have wealthy farmers with thousands of acres of land and hundreds of animals.
Mm.
You wouldn't have gold and jade, but they are decent people and you'd always have food.
To understand the gravity of that moment, you really have to understand the rigid social stratification of the Qing dynasty.
It was incredibly strict, right?
For an aristocratic noble family like the Jias, the idea of marrying a daughter to a rural farmer, even a wealthy farmer with 1,000 acres, would have been unspeakably insulting in the past.
Like grounds for being thrown out of the house.
It would be an absolute degradation of their social status. It would mean they had officially fallen out of the nobility.
But Feng Ji doesn't get offended. She actually looks at Granny Lu and says, you go ask them. I'm willing to give her to them.
And Granny Lu thinks she's just joking.
Right. She thinks it's a dark joke. But Feng Ji is entirely serious. I have to use an analogy here because it just blows my mind.
Go for it.
It is exactly like a disgraced, bankrupt CEO of a massive Wall Street bank facing federal indictments, sitting in his empty foreclosed mansion.
Okay, I can see the picture.
And the only person who still visits him is the office janitor he gave a bonus to 5 years ago. And as the CEO is so desperate, he looks at the janitor and says, please, can my kid come work for your plumbing business?
That is a brilliant modern equivalent. It perfectly captures the desperation.
Right. The mighty have truly fallen.
Feng Ji's intelligence hasn't left her. Her priorities have just brutally shifted. She realizes that the institutional power of the aristocracy is a sinking ship.
The titles don't mean anything if you're starving.
The gold, the jade, the titles, they are utterly worthless now. They can't stop the debt collectors and they can't stop the ghosts.
What matters is survival.
Land. Oh, well, vegetables. The very things she used to look down upon as vulgar and beneath her are now the only tangible things that offer true security.
And she is so desperate for that security that she initiates this incredible spiritual exchange.
It's a fascinating moment of transaction.
She takes off a heavy, expensive gold bracelet from her own wrist and shoves it at Granny Lu. She begs Granny Lu to take the gold, go back to her village, and pray to her village gods for Feng Ji to get better and to protect her daughter.
This transaction perfectly encapsulates the fundamental difference between their worldviews.
How do you mean?
Well, Feng Ji is still operating under the mechanisms of aristocratic materialism. She believes she can literally buy the favor of the gods.
She thinks it's a financial transaction.
She thinks spiritual salvation requires a massive payment, much like how she handled all her earthly problems, bribing her way out.
But Granny Lu refuses the gold. She pushes it back and says, Auntie, we don't need that. In our village, when we make a vow to the gods, it only costs a few copper coins.
It's a beautiful moment of grounded faith.
She tells her, the gods don't want your gold. Just wait until you're better. And you can spend whatever you want.
Granny Lu is highlighting the practical, grounded spirituality of the peasant class versus the bloated, transactional nature of the wealthy.
The gods aren't corrupt officials.
Exactly. The village gods don't require bribes. They require genuine intent. Granny Lu offers Feng Ji something money cannot buy, authentic intercession and comfort.
And for a brief, shining moment, Feng Ji actually finds a sliver of peace.
She really does calm down.
She feels secure knowing this pragmatic, honest woman is going to pray for her. She even tells her maids to leave the room so she can confide in Granny Lou about the ghosts and the hallucinations.
She trusts the peasant woman more than her own family.
It is a moment of profound vulnerability.
It is. But of course, this is Dream of the Red Chamber.
Right. So that fleeting moment of comfort is violently interrupted. Just as Feng Ji finds a tiny bit of spiritual relief, the harsh, unforgiving, ugly reality of her financial ruin literally stomps right through the door.
The reality that walks through the door is Jilian, Feng Ji's husband.
And the vibe shifts instantly.
The shift in tone is architectural as much as it is emotional. We've just had this deeply intimate spiritual conversation between two women in the inner chamber.
Very quiet, very personal.
And then Jilian enters, completely ignores the fact that his wife is wasting away, sits in the outer receiving room, and starts making demands.
He is absolutely furious. He's panting with rage and panic. He doesn't even offer a greeting.
He's all business.
He immediately demands the keys to Feng Ji's personal cabinets from Pinger, the maid. He says they are short 4,000 to 5,000 silver taels for the deceased matriarch's funeral and other mounting debts.
He's ready to liquidate everything.
He needs to sell off Fenji's personal belongings, her last shred of security, just to cover the immediate cash flow problem.
We really need to pause and explain what 4,000 to 5,000 silver taels actually means, because it sounds like a fantasy number to a modern listener.
Yeah, let's contextualize that wealth.
A tael was a unit of weight, roughly an ounce of silver. In the economy of this era, a single tael could feed a peasant family like Granny Liu's for an entire month.
Wait, really? A single tael? So 4,000 or 5,000 taels is...
It is an astronomical fortune. We are talking about millions of dollars in modern purchasing power.
Just massive, massive wealth.
And they are short this amount just for the funeral.
That is insane. Why on earth would they spend millions on a funeral when the family is clearly bankrupt? I mean, they're broke. Right. The societal expectations.
In traditional Chinese society, filial piety, the respect and duty owed to one's parents and ancestors, was not just a moral suggestion. It was the absolute bedrock of the social and legal order.
It was enforced, essentially.
It functioned almost like a modern social credit score. If a noble family failed to provide a lavish, incredibly expensive funeral for their matriarch, it would signal to the entire empire that they were morally bankrupt.
And financially insolvent.
Exactly.
So it's basically a massive PR campaign just to keep the creditors at bay.
Yes. If they fail to put on the show, they lose all social standing, their credit dries up instantly, and they could face political ruin or even imperial punishment.
That completely changes how I view Jilian in this scene.
It adds a lot of necessary context to his panic.
Initially, he looks like an absolute villain. He is incredibly callous. He sits in the outer room pacing, sweating over ledgers, and he actually blames the women for the family's ruin.
He's lashing out at whoever is closest.
He yells at Pinger, "The earlier messes were your doing." Meanwhile, his wife is dying in the next room.
The architecture of the room really reflects the architecture of their marriage.
How so?
You have the outer room, which represents the public face, the ledgers, the external debts, the performative aspects of the family. Jilian is trapped there.
Dealing with the external crisis.
Then you have the inner room, representing the private, emotional, physical reality. Feng Ji is trapped there.
Dealing with the internal psychological crisis.
They are separated by a wall, but they might as well be on different planets.
I have to push back a little on labeling Jilian as just a cold-hearted monster here, though.
Let's hear it.
I mean, yes, his behavior is abhorrent. He's being a terrible husband. But isn't he also just a victim of a massive systemic collapse?
In many ways, yes.
He has been tasked to find money that simply does not exist. He's holding the bag on a multi-generational Ponzi scheme of debt and extravagance.
He's the one left to clean up the mess.
He is desperately trying to maintain the facade so the family isn't literally thrown onto the streets. Can we really blame him for panicking?
That is the brilliance of the text. It doesn't traffic in simple heroes and villains.
It's way more complicated than that.
Jilian is the manager of a bankrupt corporation trying to hide the insolvency from the shareholders. His callousness is a trauma response to an impossible financial reality.
He's in full fight or flight mode.
He has no emotional bandwidth left for his dying wife because he's terrified of absolute social ruin.
It's a masterclass in contrasting human priorities. And Pinger, the maid, is caught right in the middle of it.
She's in such an awful position.
She has the keys to the cabinets. She knows Feng Ji is dying. And here's the husband demanding the last of their personal wealth.
She sees both sides of the wall.
Pinger cries out in sheer frustration, saying, if you have something to say, say it clearly, even if it kills a person.
She's begging for some humanity.
She is crying over a human life while Jilian is stomping his foot and crying over a balance sheet.
And when Jilian finally looks into the inner room and sees Fengji clawing at the air, his reaction isn't to comfort her.
Not at all.
He stomps his foot and says, if it's come to this, it's going to cost me my life.
He's crying for himself. He's mourning the inconvenience of her dying, right when he needs her money and her managerial skills to help navigate the funeral logistics.
It is the ultimate collapse of a partnership into pure transaction.
It's so bleak.
But what's fascinating here is that while this older generation, Jilian Fengji, is completely obsessed with money, ledgers, and physical survival, the younger generation in the estate is experiencing a completely different kind of crisis.
They're living a completely different nightmare.
They aren't worried about the balance sheets. They are facing an existential crisis of meaning.
Which brings us to Baoyu. We shift perspectives completely away from the dying Fengji and the panicking Jilian, and we move to Baoyu, the young heir to the family.
He is the emotional core of the younger generation.
Baoyu is the poetic soul of the novel. He is currently distraught, but not over the millions in debt or the funeral costs.
He doesn't even seem to care about the money.
He is agonizing over rumors that Miaoyu, a beautiful and pure nun living on the estate, has been kidnapped by bandits.
Baoyu's grief here is deeply philosophical. He hears these rumors. Some servants say she was kidnapped. Some maliciously whisper she ran away out of lust.
Which is just awful gossip.
But Baoyu believes she was taken by force and will probably die rather than submit. He is pacing his room, crying, and he starts reading the philosophy of Zhuangzi.
For those of us who aren't familiar, who is Zhuangzi and why is Baoyu reading him right now?
Zhuangzi was a foundational philosopher of Taoism.
Okay, so a very different school of thought from Confucianism.
Exactly. Taoism, in stark contrast to the rigid, duty-bound social structures of Confucianism, emphasizes harmony with the natural flow of the universe.
Detachment from the world.
Detachment from worldly ambitions and the recognition of impermanence. By reading Zhuangzi, Baoyu is trying to find comfort in the idea that life is just drifting clouds.
Trying to intellectualize his grief.
He is trying to accept that the people he loves are temporary phenomena that eventually scatter to the wind.
He's sitting there mourning the fact that all the pure, beautiful, untainted people from his youth are either dead, married off, or kidnapped.
He's mourning the end of an era.
The end of his innocence, really. But then his wife, Bao Chai, enters the room.
And she is not amused by his poetry.
Not at all. Bao Chai sees him crying over ancient philosophy, and she immediately scolds him.
She gives him a severe reality check.
She essentially says, look at your nephew, Jialan. He's studying day and night. You are the heir. The family is relying on you to pass the imperial exams and rebuild our legacy. Stop wasting your time on idle, tragic thoughts and take responsibility.
This argument between them highlights the central ideological conflict of the entire era.
It's the core debate of the book, isn't it?
Very much so. Bao Chai is the voice of traditional Confucian duty. In a time of crisis, the Confucian response is action.
Study, rebuild the structure, fulfill your role.
Precisely. The imperial exam system she mentions wasn't just a college entrance test. It was the sole mechanism for social mobility and political survival in the empire.
It was everything.
It required years of agonizing, rote memorization of classic texts to write highly structured, eight-legged essays.
It was a system that literally broke men's minds, right?
Absolutely. Young men would be locked in tiny cells for days to take these exams. Many went mad or died of exhaustion.
Just the pressure alone must have been crushing.
The psychological burden on Baoyu to pass these exams and save his ruined family is unimaginable.
So I have to look at their dynamic here. I keep picturing Baoyu and Bao Chai as two people standing on the deck of the Titanic after it hit the iceberg.
Oh, that's a vivid comparison.
Baoyu wants to pull up a deck chair, look up at the stars, and write a profoundly beautiful, tragic poem about the inevitability of the ship going down.
He wants to experience the melancholy.
He wants to feel the tragedy of the sinking ship. But Bao Chai is shoving a heavy wooden bucket into his hands and screaming, "Start bailing the water."
That is a phenomenal way to frame it. The tragedy of their marriage is that neither of them is entirely wrong.
Right. They both have a point.
The ship is going down and the tragedy is profound. From Bao Chai's perspective, if everyone just sits around writing poetry about drifting clouds, they drown faster. You have to bail the water.
But from Baoyu's perspective, bailing water is pointless if the hull is already ripped open.
The water is coming in no matter what.
Exactly. Why lose your soul to the grueling mechanics of survival? Why force yourself to study for exams in a corrupt political system when the beautiful world you loved is already ending?
And that fundamental disagreement creates a massive, impenetrable wall between them.
They just can't see eye to eye.
Bao Yu looks at Bao Chai and says, I don't care about their business. I just lament our family's declining luck. And Bao Chai replies, your parents want you to be a man and continue the ancestral line, and you are just stubbornly obsessed.
They're speaking entirely different languages.
They are looking at the exact same crisis and drawing completely incompatible conclusions about how a human being should respond.
It makes me wonder, and I want you, the listener, to think about this. How do you process a major crisis?
It's a very revealing question.
When the foundation of your life, your career, or your family cracks, are you about you? Do you seek to understand the philosophical meaning of the loss? To mourn the beauty of what is gone?
Or are you about Chai?
Right. Do you immediately focus on practical action, on fixing the problem, on doing your duty, no matter how emotionally numb it makes you feel?
It is the eternal tension between feeling and doing.
And because Bao Yu cannot find any comfort in Bao Chai's rigid practicality, he feels incredibly lonely.
He has no outlet for his grief.
The ship is sinking, his wife is handing him a bucket, and he just wants someone to hold his hand and acknowledge that the water is freezing.
He needs emotional validation.
He decides he needs to find someone who understands his emotional depth, someone who remembers the past the way he does. And this leads us to what is, without a doubt, the most heart-wrenching scene in the entire chapter.
It is a devastating sequence. Bai Yu waits until nightfall. He sneaks out of his room to visit a maid named Ziwan.
Now, to understand the weight of this encounter, we have to know Ziwan's history.
She wasn't just any maid.
No. She was the fiercely loyal maid of Lin Daiyu. Daiyu was Baiyu's true love, his absolute soulmate, who died tragically earlier in the novel.
The great tragedy of his life.
Baiyu was tricked into marrying Bao Chai while he was desperately ill, and Daiyu died of a broken heart, believing he had betrayed her. Ziwan has been cold and distant to Baiyu ever since.
The atmosphere of this scene is just dripping with melancholy. Baiyu sneaks into the courtyard in the freezing cold.
It's so cinematic.
He walks up to Ziwan's window. He sees the faint glow of a light inside. And in a moment of pure, desperate intimacy, he literally licks the paper window to make a tiny hole so he can peek inside without making a sound.
The tactile detail of licking the paper window to dissolve it is so poignant.
It's such delicate action.
He is trying to dissolve the barrier between them just enough to see her.
He sees Ziwan sitting there alone, just staring blankly. He calls out to her softly, asking if he can come in and talk.
And her response?
Ziwan's response is a masterclass in quiet devastation. She pauses for a long time and then says, it's late. Please go back. Whatever you have to say, say it tomorrow.
Ouch.
She completely refuses to unlatch the door.
The emotional barrier here is immense. Ziwan's rejection isn't just about being annoyed that it's late.
No, it goes much deeper than that.
It is born of a profound, unyielding loyalty to the dead Daiyu. Ziwan views Bao Yu's very survival, let alone his marriage to Bao Chai, as a fundamental betrayal of Daiyu's memory.
It's a form of survivor's guilt projected onto him.
She knows, logically, that Bao Yu was sick. She knows he was manipulated by the family elders. But emotionally, she cannot forgive him for being alive while her mistress is dead.
The physical barrier in this scene is doing so much heavy lifting. You have the locked wooden door and the fragile paper window.
The physical manifesting the emotion.
Exactly. Bao Yu is literally and figuratively shut out of the past he so desperately wants to apologize for. He is standing in the cold, crying, pleading with her.
He says, if I've done something wrong, tell me. Even if you ignore me forever, at least let me die a ghost who understands why.
He just wants closure. He wants to be understood.
But Ziwan denies him that closure. She replies with a cold laugh through the door. I'm just a servant sent by the madam. If we're bad, complain to the madam. We servants don't matter.
She is weaponizing her lower class status to build an impenetrable wall between them.
She's reminding him of the hierarchy that allowed him to survive while Daiyu died.
It's a very sharp defense mechanism.
But even as she says it, the text notes she starts choking on her words and crying.
So now, you have both of them standing on opposite sides of this thin paper door, shivering in the cold, sobbing, completely unable to reach each other.
It's agonizing to read.
He says, do you want me to hold it in until I die? He is begging for the chance to explain his heart.
And just as the tension reaches its absolute peak when you think maybe, just maybe, she may finally slide the latch open.
The moment is violently shattered.
Xie Yu, another maid, suddenly speaks up from right behind Bao Yu.
This interruption is critical to the themes of the novel. Xieyu scolds Ziwan. She says, "Who are you to make the master beg you in the freezing cold? You're being cruel."
She completely ruins it.
Xieyu completely misses the emotional nuance of the scene. She only sees a servant being insubordinate to a master.
Xieyu brings the rigid, unforgiving class hierarchy crashing down on this fragile, intimate moment.
It's a harsh reminder of their reality.
Baoyu realizes instantly that he can't have a real human conversation now. The spell is broken. The societal roles have been reasserted.
There's no space for their shared grief anymore.
He retreats, walking away with Xieyu, saying, "I'll never be able to explain this heart in this lifetime. Only heaven knows." He is totally defeated.
And this is where we reach the philosophical climax of the text. Because after Baoyu walks away in the snow, we remain in the room with Ziwan.
We get to hear her internal monologue.
Right. She sits in a room, crying through the night, and she contemplates the tragedy of human relationships.
She thinks to herself, "I know Baoyu didn't mean to betray Daiyu. I know he was sick and manipulated. I see his genuine emotion tonight."
She acknowledges his truth.
But then she reaches a deeply cynical, devastating conclusion.
Yes, she thinks, what is the point of all this deep emotion? Our poor Lin Daiyu had no luck to enjoy his love. When it comes down to it, relationships just end in people either being clueless or crying under the moon.
The dead don't know anything, and the living are just left with endless, agonizing pain.
She looks at the wreckage around her. She has seen what happened to Daiyu's passion. She has seen what happened to Fengji's ambition.
She has seen Baoyu weeping in the snow.
And she thinks the final crushing thought, "When I calculate it all, it is truly better to be unfeeling grass and wood without knowledge or feeling, so that the heart remains clean."
Unfeeling grass and wood. She is essentially concluding that human empathy is a trap.
That it's inherently destructive.
That connection inevitably leads to such profound loss, guilt, and misunderstanding that it's actually better to be an inanimate object, to just not feel anything at all.
It is the ultimate retreat from vulnerability. After seeing the destruction wrought by human desires, Ziwan decides that the only safety in this world is total emotional numbness.